wild animals have been suffering since they have existed, since life on Earth originated. And with that, we have part two of our interview with Brian Tomasik on wild animal suffering.
That's certainly the, I guess, the interesting equation that, depending on who you are, you might then think, well, how many months of, say, normal animal existence is going to be worthwhile to exist for between 5 minutes and, say, several hours of extreme suffering at the end of it?
Right.
Certainly, at least humans, with our peak end rule, if the end of something is bad, you experience the whole thing is terrible. But here is a bit odd, because the end is your death, so it's not like you can have your after death looking back at your terrible death itself.
Yeah.
I guess intuitively I can't, at the moment I feel that animals move around and they'll experience some stressors, like as you're saying, when different organisms are introduced to different predators, but of course that's the evolutionary design so that they don't actually get attacked, and because they're putting in mechanisms or engaging in certain behaviors to make it less likely to be prey. But it doesn't seem so bad. But then there's a different intuition, which is that all the time you're making sure you don't get eaten, and that seems terrible.
Yeah, an animal needs a stress to be able to, like, survive, right? It's constant pain, in a way.
Right. There's the hedonic treadmill, which we might think helps to offset the badness of any given hardship that animals experience. I mean, this relates to the fact that people say those in the third world might be as happy as those in the first world. So I'm not sure if that's true. I mean, there are some studies showing that happiness increases with income up to, say, $10,000 a year. And, like, it's hard to argue that people in the Middle Ages were as happy as we are now, although maybe you can't just make that judgment intuitively because you have a certain hedonic expectations that a medieval peasant wouldn't have.
No, the calculations are so difficult to do because of your complete expectation of what your world is. Mm-hmm. And then if things are... Usually I think a life is often about expectation management, that if you have a certain frame of expectations, you can end up a lot happier than if you had a different set. And as you're indicating, if you're in the Middle Ages, it's not like if you came upon a dirty, flushable toilet, you'd be as displeased as we are now. You'd be like, oh my God, this is magic.
Right, yeah. But the flip side is the hedonic treadmill is not absolute because there are, like, depression. Some people may be permanently depressed, for example. Some people have an extremely high set point. So there are cases where happiness is not always relative to your past states. And it could be in the case of being afraid of predators, for example, that could be systematically worse than not being afraid of predators because like suffering, the difference this gets to the question of what's the difference between suffering and happiness, because both are forms of emotions that motivate you to do something. And one possibility is that suffering is an attempt to avoid, and happiness is or at least kind of a brain change that inclines you to seek. And so predation would be always about, or fear of predation would be always about trying to avoid something. And so that could be negative by its nature. It's like, it's hard to imagine that, or it doesn't necessarily make sense that trying to avoid predators would ever be an enjoyable experience. It's possible it could be. Like there are cases, for example, hunger, where you both have a negative experience of being hungry and a positive experience of eating. And the motivation comes from both of those parts. But there are some things that are like always bad and some things that are seemingly always good or neutral. And they seem to be cases where you're trying to always avoid something or always seek something. So it's very hard to nail this down, and we'd have to think more about it to decide where we want to set the threshold of right. Negative versus positive experiences. But that's just some points to suggest that it's not always going to come out to zero for any organism.
Right. So as a sort of a general recap at this point, we've sort of started with the idea that suffering itself matters, which, you know, it's kind of hard to argue against. Animal suffering also matters. Right? As you pointed out, humans are also animals, so it's just a different type of animal, that non-human animal we're talking about. There are many more wild animals than there are domesticated or animals that are factory farmed, and not all of their lives are good, and maybe even you think some of them on balance are negative in terms of suffering. if this is the case, these hundreds of billions or trillions and trillions of wild animals of different types are suffering like this, is there anything humans could actually do about it?
There are several, although it's not always going to be obvious. The most common response from those who are otherwise sympathetic to animal suffering is that there's nothing we can do about it. So it might be that wild animal suffering dominates in magnitude over all other kinds of animal suffering in just its sheer quantity, but the relevant question is how much can we reduce by our actions, not how much there is in total. Usually how much there is in total correlates with how much you can reduce it, but that's not always the case. So just from the sheer number of wild animals, it doesn't automatically follow that wild animal suffering is the most important action relevant issue. But I think there are many cases where we can, in fact, have an impact. I mean, it's not the case that humans do nothing to affect wild animals, because we're doing that all the time, every day, through our environmental policies and choices. So one thing that we could do is study in greater depth how the policies that we already undertake are affecting wild animals, and also how we could change them to make the situation better. And there are some animal organizations that look into this. I mean, there are a lot of wildlife groups and things, but I think they take, from my perspective, they take the wrong approach, because they tend to assume that wild animal lives are good and therefore we should try to preserve them as much as possible. And if their assumption is wrong, then what they're doing might be actually harmful rather than positive. So, given that I think there's a lot of suffering in nature, it's quite plausible that, say, having a development park implies less suffering, at least in the short term, than what would have been there instead. And so it's possible that a lot of animal organizations that focus on wild animals at all are doing it in the wrong way. And some wildlife groups also don't seem to care so much about the suffering as they do about other values. So there are actually several different organizations whose entire goal is to restore predators or oppose the removal of predators from certain areas in the US or in Europe. And usually they do it just because they think of predators as majestic, or they do rightly recognize that people are harming the predators themselves. For example, if predators are hunted to make it safer for livestock to graze in some area, the wildlife specialists who kill the predators do actually cause them harm and cause them pain. But what these groups ignore is the harm and pain that those predators caused to many, many wildlife. Each predator eats many prey in its lifetime.
It is interesting how we sort of have these mental categories of what counts in one domain and what counts in another. So there's many people who'd be very concerned by, say, a human mistreating a dog or a bird or a cat. And then these same people might actually thinking, you know, we should introduce this predator because it's important. We don't want that particular predator to not have a flourishing life, and then not sort of add up all the suffering that's going to be accounted for that. It's sort of the same way that, you know, people are happy to have dogs and cats as pets, and then they like to eat other similarly capable organisms.
Right. And if a predator were eating a human, we wouldn't say that's natural, and we also wouldn't say that's a way to control environmental damage. I mean, often people argue for predators because, for example, in Yellowstone, when predators were removed, the prey overconsumed the plants, and then there was less vegetation. But humans are overconsuming plants and causing vastly more environmental damage than the deer and herbivores in Yellowstone did. But we don't favor predators eating humans to reduce the environmental damage that humans cause. And the environmental damage that herbivores cause may actually not be bad anyway if you think that wildlife suffers more than it enjoys its existence, because the herbivores may have relatively long and good lives, whereas the food that they're eating would otherwise have been eaten by smaller animals, maybe insects, maybe like smaller mice and so on. So having deer eat a lot of plants might not be bad when all things are considered, because the deer are longer lived. They have less infant mortality and have better lives overall. So those are the kinds of questions that we can ask. The first thing to do with wild animal suffering is to think more about it, basically, and raise concern about the issue, study it more, try to collect more insights. There's a whole field of ecology and conservation biology, and like there are many, many insights about how ecosystems work, and all this knowledge could be applied to the welfare of the animals rather than just their survival dynamics and population trends and so on. And so there's a vast field of welfare biology, as Yu Kuang Eng calls it, that's waiting to be done. Just kind of taking the ecology that we already know and finding out its implications for happiness and suffering. Yeah, so that's the more immediate term thing that we can do. And then I would say there's one other thing that I think is important, which is I mentioned spreading concern for wild animals, and that matters because humans in the future will have vastly greater ability to affect wild animals than humans in the present do, when we have artificial intelligence and nanotechnology and things like that. And I'm not suggesting that we should advance technology faster to get to that point, because I think technology can be very dangerous for other reasons. But when the technology comes, it's important that humans use it well. So having more people care about wild animal suffering in the same way that we today care about malaria or Ebola, to use a current example. Ebola is a form of natural suffering that we think should not happen. So if that same sort of idea were applied more broadly, then there's a greater chance that humans would use technologies in a positive way, and also that they wouldn't inadvertently cause vastly more wild animal suffering. So there are some speculative future scenarios that could happen that would actually multiply the amount of animal suffering many times what's currently on Earth. One of them is called terraforming, which is the idea of converting another planet like Mars to more Earth-like conditions by introducing plants so that they can create oxygen, and then eventually you can bring in animals. And so there are doubts about whether terraforming is possible, but in general, that kind of idea of spreading wildlife to other planets to improve habitability would multiply animal suffering. And a lot of times people involved in space colonization think about it as an engineering challenge, but don't think about the lives of the animals that are actually involved in the process. A related proposal is called directed panspermia, where people would spread, rather than actively cultivating good conditions on a single planet, people would spread the seeds of life to many other planets. And the hope is that some of them would take root on planets that happen to be suitable enough for life. Some people say that we have a moral imperative to spread life because the purpose of life is to spread itself, and life is inherently valuable, and so we should produce as much of it as we can. And again, these ignore the suffering that the life actually has to experience. And then one more possible way in which humans could multiply wild animal suffering is in simulations. If they create digital simulations of wildlife that are accurate enough to actually be sentient, then that could suffer in the same way that ordinary wildlife does. We can hope that people would engineer the simulations to maybe avoid the suffering. So when a prey is about to be eaten, maybe you switch off its aversion subroutines. So there's room to make the simulations more humane, but we have to care about wild animals in the first place before people are going to ask those kinds of questions.
Right. I think you've made a series of excellent points, especially the idea that we have to study this a lot more. And certainly, at least when you're talking to individuals, there is a difference between admitting that there is a problem and then whether you can do anything about it. And I think sometimes people, almost subconsciously, because they think it's too big or they feel there's futility, then they don't want to believe there is a problem. And then I guess if you move up the rung of acceptance, like, well, there is a problem, but we can't do anything about it, then there is a problem, maybe we can do something about it. And I think you outlined a lot of different interesting issues. For me, I was thinking, is there a tactical issue here? Is that at the moment, it seems like more people are becoming more aware of animal suffering and factory farming and stuff like that. But I'm not sure if people are ready to leap to the idea of wild animal suffering, because there's always this naturalistic fallacy that seems to pervade a lot of people. Hmm. And will the idea of reducing factory farming be inadvertently harmed by focusing on what some people might see as, well, preposterous, for lack of a better word?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'll go back to something else you said and then come to that point. So about the seeming helplessness. So I have called this learned helplessness, or a kind of learned helplessness in the domain of wild animal suffering, where, so if you're a person in the Middle Ages, there's very little you can do about wild animal suffering on a large scale, since you don't have technology. So what you do is try to cope with the problem and say it's God's will, or it's due to the sins of Adam and Eve, or it's the natural order and it should be that way. And so as a psychological strategy for making yourself feel better, you say that's the way it should be because I can't change it. And so that's sort of a way to cope with the problem. Then later on, if it does become possible to change the situation, if you take your original excuse too seriously, you might still think you shouldn't fix it, even though now you can. So that's why I call it a kind of learned helplessness. Originally, you couldn't do anything about it. Now, if you can, you still don't do anything about it. And we see this in other areas too, like a classic case is trying to end aging. Aubrey de Grey has raised this point where people say aging is good because of various reasons. It reduces overpopulation, or it death gives meaning to life. We wouldn't value life if we could live for a long time, things like that. And people take those excuses so literally that originally they maybe invented those excuses as a way to come to terms with the inevitable. And now if it's no longer inevitable, they still sometimes believe it so much that they don't try to change things. So there's something similar in the case of wild animal suffering. It's now becoming potentially conceivable that in the future we could do something about it on a larger scale, but people take their original excuses too seriously and still don't think there needs to be something done because they've created this ideology of the way the natural order should work and so on.
Right.
It's interesting that a lot of the original discussion of wild animal suffering was in the context of the problem of evil, because in the past, the only person who could conceivably do something about wild animal suffering was God, because humans were too feckless to be able to have a large scale impact. Now that humans might actually be in a position, we are going to be more in the position of God to decide these questions. So it may become the human problem of evil. Why are humans permitting this suffering to continue when they could stop it? And that's especially salient in the case of spreading animal life to space, because we are the ones who are making the decision to create more life. So the problem of evil is especially applicable to us in that context.
Right.
So as far as your question, is it too radical and will it turn people away to talk about this? It's an important concern. And I think it's good to focus on different audiences with different messages. I wouldn't talk too much about wild animal suffering with somebody who doesn't even think animals matter, because as you say, you probably have to go in stages, and wild animal suffering is often used as a reductio ad absurdum against caring about animals in general. It's sometimes taken as an argument against vegetarianism. People say lions eat gazelles, so it's okay for humans to eat their own prey. And if it's wrong for humans to eat their own prey, isn't it wrong for lions to eat gazelles too? But that's absurd, so vegetarianism must not be required. So one man's modus tollens is another's modus ponens. And the wild animal suffering argument is saying, yeah, it's bad when lions eat gazelles too. But since that's usually used as reductio, that shows that it's a very radical conclusion. So I think wild animal suffering is best discussed among animal advocates who already care about animals, maybe among transhumanists or kind of people who are interested in technology, for whom the idea is not radical in the first place. In fact, a lot of the interest in wild animal suffering came from transhumanists like David Pearce, who contemplate that it might actually be possible to do something about wild animal suffering, even though we can also do things through more ordinary research like ecology and studying the impacts that we're already having, even without advanced technology. And then also just open-minded people in general, like academics and effective altruists and others who are not as scared of strange ideas.
It's very important to know your audience. So as a quick note to the listeners of our show, we're trusting you by the honor system to not misuse this information against nice people who are having decent arguments about the pros or cons about eating animals or animal welfare in general. So great power, great responsibility. Unfortunately, we seem to be out of time. So Brian, thank you so much for talking to us today about wild animal suffering.
It was a great pleasure.
If someone wanted to explore more, where should they go?
I've written several essays on the topic on my website, utilitarian-essays.com. There have been several other authors who have talked about this issue too. One is Oscar Horta. He's a professor of philosophy. He's written about natural disvalue and the harm of predation and things like that. David Pierce is another philosopher who has written about the problem of wild animal suffering and the possibility of changing nature for the better. There are lots of other authors that you can find. Oscar Horta has a bibliography of different papers that have been written on this topic. And there's a Facebook group called Reducing Wild Animal Suffering that you can search for, where we talk about these things on a daily basis.